Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll deal with a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and go to Israel and speak with Dr. Tanya Reinhardt, who's an Israeli professor of linguistics at Tel Aviv University, who writes frequently on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. She's authored a new book, Israel-Palestine, How to End the War of 1948. And her forthcoming book is Roadmap to Nowhere, Israel-Palestine Since 2003. And we'll look into the latest incursion into Gaza by the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, and what kind of a deal might end the incursion. We'll also go to Mexico City and speak with Luis Mendoki, who's an acclaimed film director who works in Mexico and in Hollywood. His most recent film is Who is Mr. Lopez?, a documentary which follows the life and campaign of the leftist presidential candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador, whose supporters, 300,000 strong, Saturday, were in the main square in Mexico City crying fraud. So we'll look into where this cliffhanger of an election which candidate will end up being the president and what will happen in the meantime. And we'll also speak with Dr. Anne Norton, who's a professor of political science and comparative literature at the University of Pennsylvania. She's the author, most recently, of Leo Strauss and the Politics of American Empire. She also has a new article in Adbusters entitled, Is It Fascism Yet? And her forthcoming book is Abu Ghraib and the American Soul. We're talking to her about, in the face of a manifest foreign policy disaster, the neoconservatives who control American foreign policy seem to be more and more entrenched than ever in the Bush administration. So we look into that paradox. I'm now speaking with Dr. Tanya Reinhardt, who is in Israel. She's a professor of linguistics at Tel Aviv University. Her forthcoming book, as I mentioned, is Roadmap to Nowhere, Israel-Palestine Since 2003. And she's also the author of Israel-Palestine, How to End the War of 1948. And, of course, the War of 67 is the that's when Israel inherited the West Bank. And even though there was a recent withdrawal from Gaza, now the Israeli Defense Forces have re-entered. And as we speak, there seems to be some sort of deal in the offing here where the Israeli military will withdraw, and that sometime later there will be some reciprocity in terms of prisoner exchange. But at this point, Tanya, what is the status of the Israeli soldier that this military campaign is designed to force the release of him?
Well, I have to first mention that I don't think it's the imprisoned Israeli soldier that triggered this operation. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be a military analyst to know that to release a war prisoner or even a hostage, you can't send an army. And on the other hand, Israel has turned down offers for prisoners released that were made right from the start. But the major reason why I think this is not the trigger is that the Israeli media was completely clear right from the start that the goals of the operations were planned long ahead, long before. And in fact, Israel has been escalating the situation in Gaza for a month now, since it started in June 8th when they assassinated Jamal Abu Samahadna, who was appointed by the Hamas government as the head of the security forces of the internal ministry. So there was the first assassination, followed by the killing of civilians, the Ralia family, and then other civilians in Gaza. So they have been creating a situation of escalation, and the military operation was already planned when the event of the military outpost and the imprisoning of the soldier took place.
So in other words, if this is a pretext, the kidnapping of the soldier, for an already pre-existing military plan to re-enter Gaza, what is, in your opinion, Tanya Reinhardt, the military objective here?
And again, this is not a matter of just opinion. The Israeli media is very open about the military objectives, and a major objective is toppling the Hamas government and the whole administration of the Hamas. And the day it started on 29th of June, it was accompanied with a massive arrest of the Hamas leadership in the parliament members, even ministers in the West Bank, because they were accessible, and even the Israeli defense minister announced that Haniyeh, the prime minister, is also a target. So the real objective is toppling the government, and from what I understand, the U.S. supports this aim behind the scenes, though it encourages Israel to avoid as much as possible hurting civilians, but the aim itself is acceptable to the U.S.
So how do you topple a government in the Palestinian territories and expect the Palestinians to accept a government at the point of a gun? I mean, obviously the Palestinians elected Hamas, and in post-election analysis, it's pretty clear that it was largely a rejection of Fatah that led to this situation. However, they are the elected government, and does anybody seriously believe that the Palestinian people will accept a government replaced by Israel?
Well, we are at the point that Palestinian opinion does not really matter. No one asks the Palestinians, and indeed, as you point out, this is an absurd and hardly imaginable situation. It's the U.S. and Europe decided, despite Israel's opposition, to permit the Palestinian people to hold democratic elections. And so, according to Jimmy Carter's report in the Herald Tribune, the elections were honest, fair, strongly contested, and he says that among the 62 elections that have been monitored by the Carter team, these were among the best in portraying the will of the people. And indeed, the Palestinian people voted not for religion, and only a third of the Palestinians are Islamic religion people, but against the previous government. So in a just and well-ordered world, it would be unthinkable for a government that was elected in this way to be disqualified because Israel doesn't like the choice of the elections. But in a world in which the U.S. rules, might is right, and might can define democracy as it chooses. So the whole Western world imposed severe sanctions, and particularly the U.S., a resolution of this sort was just passed about 3 weeks ago or so. Severe sanctions, economical sanctions, both the West Bank and Gaza are on the verge of starving. There are no salaries, there are no pensions, so the whole system is collapsing. And the hope was that the government will collapse, but in fact, it does not happen. On the contrary, I mean, another hope was that the Palestinians will get into civil war, that the different factions will start fighting with each other, and this way create the chaos that will collapse the whole system.
Well, that looked like it was about to happen before this invasion into Gaza by the IDF. I mean, there was some street battles between Fatah and Hamas, and I imagine from the point of view of the right-wing Israelis, they may think, well, you know, we told you so. These people can't really govern themselves. But in terms of realpolitik and reality, a civil war in Palestine could hardly be good for Israel, surely. I mean, how could it not end up spilling into more of a regional war with Hezbollah in the north, and we already have chaos in Iraq, which could spread into Jordan. So I just wonder, in terms of the political debate inside Israel, is anybody pointing out the folly of the idea that a civil war amongst the Palestinians would be good for Israel?
Of course, there are people pointing it out, but the issue is that in the perspective of the Israeli military and government, a civil war is the desired effect because it would lead to the Palestinian society killing and destroying itself. And there is not much fear of this spreading because, as you may know, the Palestinian territories are no longer any integral part of the rest of the world. They have become huge prisons surrounded completely in Gaza by the Gaza fence or wall, and the West Bank wall is being completed. So Israel feels secure enough that internal battles inside the prison cannot hurt Israel, but can only damage the Palestinians. But the point of the matter, there were these talks about the civil war, and many in the Israeli security
apparatus, right? I said the security apparatus.
The apparatus expressed hope that it's about to happen, but in reality the Palestinians have stood this pressure of avoiding the occupiers' desire for a civil war. They have withstood it for many years, and right as the operation was starting, all the Palestinian factions have signed the agreement of accepting a document based on the proposal of the prisoner imprisoned Palestinians, a document that guarantees unity, and in fact also at least indirectly, it outlines the basis for negotiation with an indirect at least recognition of Israel. So there was no way, it's a hope, but it's an unrealistic hope that the Palestinians could be broken into civil war. So in fact, starvation, economical siege did not work. Pushing some factions into provoking civil war does not help.
Isn't it true that a lot of Israelis are saying to themselves, you know, we gave back the Gaza to the Palestinians, and what kind of gratitude is that? They start lobbing missiles at us. So how do you address that criticism?
Yeah, that's one other myth. Okay, so the fact of the matter is that Israel never gave up Gaza. The Israeli settlements were evacuated, but Gaza itself remained completely sealed from the world and under complete control of Israel. So Gaza is under military occupation, but from the outside. Now, Israel did not keep any of the commitment it took on the signing of the disengagement agreements, the crossings agreements. The commitment was that the Palestinians would allow access to the West Bank, that they would allow much freer access for products exchanged to Egypt, to the outside world, and they are not. So they are fully controlled by Israel, and they are since the disengagement, they are bombarded pretty heavily. It has been escalating, but the bombardment of neighborhoods in Gaza takes on since then. Sonic booms that create huge noise and wake up the children at night frequently take place since then. So in any possible respect, no Palestinian in Gaza can feel he became free following the disengagement. And the reason is clear, because Israel does not need the Gaza, one of the most crowded areas in the world in a very poor land in terms of resources. But in order to keep the West Bank, you have to keep full control of the Gaza people, because if you let them really free, as Israel claims it has, they would become the leaders of the Palestinian struggle for liberation, also in the West Bank. So Israel simply replaced the previous form of occupation with the system of prison controlled from the outside. Now, if you look at the Qassams, the rockets, besieged people with nothing to hope for, bombarded by an army that surrounds them from all sides, will always find a way to fight back. And the Qassam is a symbolic, at least in terms of its effects, It's still in their eyes, they're fighting back. They were fighting back. Nevertheless, I want to stress that the Hamas does not participate in the Qassam launching. So the Hamas itself, in January 2005, announced its resolution to replace armed struggle with political struggle and enter the election process and so on. At that time, the Hamas declared a unilateral ceasefire called Qam Tahdiya, together with the other factions. So in the 17 months since then, Hamas, well, first, it has not been involved in any single terror attack, but also avoided Qassams. So the organizations that do still launch Qassams in normal times, now it's a time of war, that's a different thing, but in normal days, there would be other organizations that would still not obey the Qam, the ceasefire. But this would be one or two rockets, not necessarily even every day, occasionally one or two rockets, which were really more symbolic because simply there were only small organizations participating in it.
Well, just in closing then, Dr. Tanya Reinhart, from the Palestinian point of view, given the poverty, the unemployment, and the economic squeeze that they're going through, I wonder whether the young men in Gaza and the West Bank, whether they look forward to a day when they can have a real job and a real life, or whether they are so nihilistic from the experience that all they understand is armed struggle. I mean, in other words, what can be done because it seems to be spiraling into nihilism?
Well, what can be done is the Haniya, the Hamas prime minister, is repeating what he thinks could be done. He thinks a ceasefire should be declared immediately, and he's willing to guarantee it as much as he can. And the problem with the previous ceasefire, the one I just discussed, is that the Hamas and most of the Palestinian factions did keep it, but Israel did not. Israel continued to assassinate, to bombard, to use sonic booms, and so on. Israel continued military activity as usual. It completely ignored. It was a one-sided fire.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us from Israel, Dr. Tanya Reinhart.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Tanya Reinhart, who's an Israeli professor of linguistics at Tel Aviv University and the author of a new book, Israel-Palestine, How to End the War of 1948. And she's doing a forthcoming book, Roadmap to Nowhere, Israel-Palestine Since 2003. I'm now speaking with Luis Mandoki, who's an acclaimed film director who works in Mexico and in Hollywood. He has made the acclaimed Innocent Voices, Angel Eyes, Amazing Grace, Message in a Bottle, and his most recent film is Who is Mr. Lopez, which follows the life and campaign of presidential candidate Andres Manuel López Obrador. And, of course, yesterday, Saturday, in the main square in Mexico City, 300,000 supporters of López Obrador were shouting fraud. What's the latest, Luis, in terms of where this struggle is heading?
Well, it's going to go to the tribunal, mm-hmm. but I think the problem is going to be solved politically, and by that I don't mean a negotiation, which is what Mexico has been used to, negotiations behind the wall. Andrés Manuel López Obrador is not that kind of politician. That's why there's so much resistance to let him in, because that would mean a cleanup of all the corruption in the country. In the meeting yesterday at the Zócalo, he played two recorded phone conversations with between a pre-governor and a secretary of communication and transport, which means federal government, where they were agreeing, they were making a negotiation for the pre to support the candidate Calderón. The day of the election, because they were worried he was going to lose. The PRI today just called for a press conference where they're going to denounce themselves the fraud. And I think what López Obrador is doing is he is showing evidence of how this election was played, and it was a very, it's probably one of the dirtiest, most fraudulent elections I've ever seen, where they used every trick that we know and more.
And of course, you've been literally on the inside with a documenting going back to the impeachment of López Obrador by Vicente Fox. Clearly, this is a man who doesn't want to be in the club. The media, I take it, have been totally supportive of the PAN and the PRI. Where is his support? Is his voters? But at what point do they get mobilized? I mean, he's calling for restraint at this point. But what's your feeling, and whether or not these are angry people who saw in 1988 the election stolen from Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas by yes. Salinas? So there's a lot of bitterness and cynicism here.
I think there's a miscalculation from Vicente Fox and all his people, in the sense that they cannot repeat 1988. People are not going to take it. People are much more mature and socially conscious. And López Obrador has always said, and he said it yesterday, this is a peaceful movement. Please, there's going to be provocations. Don't take them. We have to run the peaceful way. He called for a walk, a march from every state in the country Wednesday to come to Mexico City, where they'll congregate next Sunday for a call for democracy.
Well, now, Luis Mandoki, you were saying that it's...
I think Sunday is going to be an equivalent of La Marcha del Silencio, the silent march that stopped the desafuero. They also miscalculated, because they've thrown López Obrador into where he's like fish in the water. He knows how to play with adversity. He's not somebody who's going to negotiate. And there's always, Mexico is known for its history, where the people in power, in government, do not respect the citizens. And López Obrador's power comes from the people, comes from the city.
But the question is, does he have the numbers? And that's what's in dispute. Now, do you believe that you say it's the election is rife with fraud, yet the observers, and there is, of course, this new election commission that's been set up, even though there's no members of the PRD in the actual board of the commission, it's Priestas and PAN people, but the press here in the United States is basically saying, and the European observers are saying, it was a free and fair election. So if you could give me a sense, Luis Mandoki, of what you know about the extent of the fraud and the mechanics of the fraud.
The fraud was done in several ways. One, cybernetic, and they're going to give a conference tomorrow where they're going to prove the cybernetic fraud. Number two, I sent at election day 300 cameras to cover the voting places. I have evidence on film of representatives of the voting places where they were filling the urns. One guy filling an urn, 50 votes into it. I have it on film. And in that urn, Calderon gets 192 votes, and AMLO gets 2 votes.
So what about the high percentage of spoiled ballots, which are reminiscent of Florida in the year 2000?
Well, that's why they don't want to count the votes, because in that same place, AMLO had 2 votes, and there were 32 spoiled votes. That kind of statistic doesn't make sense. And that's why they don't want to recount. I believe that there's three possibilities. To do the recount. Number two, that the tribunal annuls the election and then they call for a new election in 12, 18 months and they put an interim president. And number three, that they force Calderón into the presidency. And then Mexico is going to be in a very difficult place. This is all going to depend on how the movement goes.
And is the press, the mainstream press that supports PAN and PRI, the Televisa and Azteca, the television in particular, are they doing what happened here in the United States in the year 2000? Remember, Gore was portrayed as the sore loser and George W. Bush as the anointed candidate. So how is the propaganda being played out between the, so that you can marginalize the PID supporters?
Basically, the media is, playing the game that the election was clean. But it's going to change in the next couple of days. If you follow it with a PRI, the PRI, denouncing now themselves the fraud, this is not going to be so simple.
So the PRI have now are crying foul as well.
They're actually giving a press conference as we speak, denouncing the fraud because of these phone calls that were played yesterday at the Zócalo, where they, and it's published today in the papers, where one of their governors was making a deal with one of the the Secretary of Communication and Transport from Vicente Fox's government. That's against the law. Somebody in the federal government cannot be doing that.
Well, also, Fox campaigning is against the law as well.
Yes. So the PRD and the PRI are going to denounce the fraud today before the tribunal. That's going to follow its course. And at the same time, there's going to be the political battle.
And what you feel?
But in terms of the fraud, there's many other evidences of, the old style, the old PRI style, which the PAN has perfected, of offering people money, food, and stuff to poor people the day before the election. As I said, filling the urns. There were also many people that were out of the database. Because I don't know if this has been very well known over there, but the IFE database was created by Calderón's brother-in-law. The IFE has denied that, and we have the documents. We have film that proves that Calderón's brother-in-law created the database and manipulated cybernetically the election, the day of the count and the day of the election. And that night of Wednesday's count, we have graphics that show and mathematically show how this fraud was done.
Well, just in closing, Luis Mandoki, there was an opinion piece published in the Los Angeles Times recently by the former foreign minister under the PAN government, Jorge Castañeda, who was claiming, and you would be in a position to comment on this since you've been on the inside with the inner circle for some time making your film, Who is yes. Mr. Lopez, claiming that that López Obrador, his key advisors and his core group of political advisors are unreconstructed priistas from, and he mentioned from Echeverria, López Portillo, implying that that somehow or other the reformer is in bed with the dinosaurs.
That's, it's funny because they've also said that he is a friend of Chavez, that Chavez has financed his campaign. I know for a fact that López Obrador has never in his life talked to Chavez. Yes, there's a couple of people that come from the PRI. The whole country was PRI at one time. There was nothing else but that. But his closest people are not linked to any political party. And his whole network has been created from a civil base and not from a party base. And so those are cheap accusations that the opposition has continued making against him to discredit him. Why? Why has he created so much noise in Mexico? Because he's clean. Because, as you said, he doesn't belong to the club, because they know that if he comes to power, they're going to have to begin paying taxes. It comes down to...
what a concept. Well, Luis Mendoza, thank you so much for joining us and for taking you away from the World Cup.
Okay, bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was speaking there with Luis Mendoza, who's an acclaimed film director who works in Mexico and in Hollywood. He directed the critically acclaimed Innocent Voices, Angel Eyes, Amazing Grace, Message in a Bottle. And his most recent film is Who is Mr. López?, a documentary that he's been making for the last several months following the life and campaign of the leftist presidential candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who has refused to concede the election in Mexico, which the press and both here in and in Mexico are anointing Calderón, the PAN candidate, the pro-business PAN party, which, of course, he will be succeeding the previous president, Vicente Fox, who's the first PAN leader to be elected after 70-plus years of one-party rule by the PRI, which is essentially a criminal organization. I'm now speaking with Dr. Anne Norton, who is a professor of political science and comparative literature at the University of Pennsylvania. She's the author of a number of books, and her most recent book is Leo Strauss and the Politics of American Empire. She also has a new article in Adbusters entitled Is It Fascism Yet? And her forthcoming book is entitled Abu Ghraib and the American Soul. And, of course, is it fascism yet? And Norton, where are we in terms of the slippery slope? The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy, which was a satire that Bertolt Brecht wrote on the rise of Hitler. And the last line in the play is, the bitch that bore Hitler is still in heat. So where are these this new crop of little Hitlers today?
I think that's right. I think she is always in heat, and it's authoritarianism. That desire for authoritarianism is always a hot one. It's always present, and it's always second, always available.
And how could it? But if there were to be fascism in America, it would seem that you know, and it's always a somewhat of a cheap shot to bring up Hitler. And clearly, there wouldn't be a German style fascism in this country. To my mind, it would be a kind of corporate Christian friendly fascism.
I think that's right. I mean, what interested me about the comparison with fascism, and I agree with you, bringing up Hitler is both a cheap shot and it's also a distraction, because people think, oh, Hitler belongs to the past, belongs somewhere else. We don't need to worry about that. But we do need to worry about authoritarianism, and we need to worry about that odd combination of corporate power, sort of a fervent evangelical apocalyptic Christianity, and a certain sort of enthusiasm for war and the romance of war, and above all, this notion of executive power as being absolutely unrestrained.
So how did this largely Jewish group of neoconservatives, how did they forge an alliance with these Christian fundamentalists, many of whom believe in the rapture and have an investment in the end of the world? In effect, what they're saying is that we, all of us, have to our world has to end in burning flesh so that their world can begin. So it's hubris doesn't even begin to describe this notion, but it's let's face it, it's the most popular book in the United States is the Left Behind series.
Well, that's a remarkable series, and it's certainly not an enticing vision for anyone who's not absolutely certain of their salvation, and something which requires a good deal of hubris, you know, in its own right. That's the question of sort of what culture produces neoconservatism, I think, it is a very interesting one. And the neoconservatives, there are lots of Jewish neoconservatives. Of course, there are lots of Jewish leftists too, as we all know. And for many years, that was the great canard. But of course, the neoconservatives draw very widely in America, and I think they draw. There are lots of Catholic neoconservatives. There are lots of Protestant ones. And I think that they can do that. They can have a broader appeal across religious traditions in the United States because they've captured a curious combination of an affection for authoritarianism and the American discourse of freedom and sort of freedom from government, freedom of property rights, and so a sort of a conception of freedom that is very open to certain kinds of authoritarianism, like individual power, even in the person of the executive, and unfettered corporate power.
But essentially, they even though they allegedly want to spread democracy abroad, ultimately, if you follow the teachings and the kind of the cult surrounding Leo Strauss, you get the distinct impression that at the end of the day, what they really believe in is Plato's noble lie. In other words, the rubes aren't smart enough to know what's good for them. So we have to create these myths that will direct the people to do the right thing. In other words, you know, the myth of the nation, the myth, you know, I mean, there's an endless examples of...
The myth of democracy in a certain sense, or the myth that democracy can be brought by some sort of some band of brothers across between a kind of military cohort filled with all that sort of romantic camaraderie of war and an evangelical missionary. That very odd combination and that way of bringing democracy to the Holy Land that captures both the sort of frontier democracy mythology of America and an apocalyptic Christian mythology. So that's a very powerful combination. I don't think it's very good either for America or for Iraq, and certainly not for democracy. But it has a lot of cultural resonance, and it's very powerful.
But in their previous incarnation, before they became the neoconservatives who brought us the Iraq War, there was the Committee on the Present Danger under Jimmy Carter that basically paved the way for Ronald Reagan's election. And they were created the myth of the evil empire and its omnipotence and its military prowess. And we all know that it was a Potemkin village that collapsed almost overnight.
Yes, that's really a fascinating mythic creation. I mean, it's one in which it's a story of the Soviet Union in which the Soviet Union has no part, in which all the sort of active roles were taken by, well, not by the United States or even by the free world, but rather by Ronald Reagan as an individual, as if he were some sort of solo leader, solo agent out there operating against an evil empire and brought it down by himself. It's not a very credible account. It's not an account with history or politics in it at all. It's an account rich with the mythology of the individual, and especially dangerously, the individual president acting alone with the military to produce a desired outcome.
But in the case of Ronald Reagan, Reagan did an end run around the neocons, the Richard Perles, who came into the administration, were essentially left high and dry when Reagan made his deal with Gorbachev. So
yes, that's right. And in the wake of Reagan is where you really find the neocons doing some quite interesting work, because, of course, when the Soviet Union, after 1989, there was that enormous possibility for peace. And what one saw instead was military buildup. And that, the effective argument for a military buildup is really enormously important. The idea that, as William Crystal and Robert Kagan so trenchantly put it, we ought not to worry about threats but opportunities, and the ability to cast that moment when there was no threat as an opportunity for American expansion, I think, was enormously important.
And that's how the peace, so-called peace dividend, went south.
The peace dividend turned into the peace deficit in an extraordinary way, in a way not unlike the way that the present financial deficit has been created, but by transforming something that was an enormous opportunity for peace, for multilateralism, for rich engagement on the ground with a variety of different political partners and political systems, and instead sort of turned the clock back to a 1950s policy of sort of single confrontation and of country-to-country confrontation, of the United States confronting an evil empire, and a time in which, in the absence of threat, we would nevertheless seize an opportunity to expand American power hegemonically, as the people who argued for that themselves call it. It was supposed to be the creation of a new world.
Well, but Dr. Ann Norton, couldn't you therefore say that in fact the better and more accurate definition of the neoconservatives is that they are basically whores for the military-industrial complex? They are salesmen for the defense budget. I mean, isn't that what Gaffney and Pearl and all these people have done all their lives? I mean, Pearl started out with the senator from Boeing, Scoop Jackson.
Uh-huh. You know, I don't think they're whores, and I'll tell you why. I think they believe it, and I think they believe it for a couple of reasons. One, because many of these people, probably an example, have held the positions they hold now for a very long time. I think that they are connected to the military-industrial complex in a very important way, and in saying military-industrial complex, I don't mean to hark back to Vietnam, but really to the United States in the 19th century when that phrase was first coined, and when it was coined by people who wanted to produce a stronger executive, a larger military, and they were described that way by the people who resisted it then in the early 19th century. So this is a very old struggle in the United States, that struggle of people who want a much stronger executive with a great deal of military power, and people who want a more authoritarian presidency, who are often historically allied with business interests, although not invariably so. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt's another example. He was, of course, in one sense the trust buster, but in another sense he was very interested in expanding executive power.
The Great White Fleet.
Yes, exactly.
But of course, it was Eisenhower who coined the phrase. I mean, the struggle, as you point out, began well before Eisenhower.
No, but you know, it's actually, I found that phrase in a book by John Taylor of Caroline in the early 19th century, around the 1800s, and it astonished me because I always thought it was Eisenhower. But I think Eisenhower may have done a little delving on his own. And certainly the idea is a very old one that, dates to that, those, you know, the people who actually were revolutionaries and anti-colonialists who in the United States, who didn't want the United States to have a standing army, and who were fundamentally defeated, unfortunately. But there is still that current that runs through the United States and rears its head up from time to time, like in the 1960s.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Dr. Ann Norton, who's a professor of political science and comparative literature at the University of Pennsylvania. She's the author of the most recent book, Leo Strauss and the Politics of American Empire. Excuse me, and she has a new article in Adbusters entitled, Is It Fascism Yet? And her forthcoming book is Abu Ghraib and the American Soul. And who would the leaders of this neoconservative movement be, given, for example, in the current issue of The New Yorker, there's a profile on David Addington, who's formerly Dick Cheney's in his sort of in-house counsel, and now he's replaced Louis Libby as the chief of staff, and it's kind of a chilling portrait of a sort of a true believer.
It's a brilliant article. It's really a lovely article, and it's very helpful because it shows something quite important about the neoconservatives and neoconservative power in Washington, and that is, sure, the leaders are very important. People like Cheney and Rumsfeld, and which we call them opinion leaders, journalists like Kristol, for example. But in some ways, even more important are people like Addington, who are virtually invisible, but who've operated for a very long time in Washington. I know a young historian in Oklahoma who's working on a man named Robert Goldwin, who from the time of the Ford administration on conducted seminars in Washington for people like Rumsfeld and Cheney and brought sort of Straussian conservative expansion of executive power teachings into Washington virtually silently for a very long time. And, you know, there are all those people in the middle bureaucracy who aren't going to leave if the administration changes, because they're not political appointees. They're just civil servants who are neoconservative and who've worked their way up through the ranks.
So who's using who? Does this neoconservative infrastructure of sort of academics and bureaucratic zealots who have kind of worked their way into the Washington machine, or is it these powerful people like Cheney and Rumsfeld? I mean, in other words, I'm trying to figure if they're using the neocons and the neocons are using Cheney.
Why not a coincidence of interest? I think that the neocons, and there are, you know, there are different kinds of neoconservatives with different paths, but what many of the neocons had to overcome was a certain aversion to corporate power. I mean, many of the neocons were academics, and they had the academics' affection for ideas over interest, perhaps. And they had to overcome that, but they overcame it real well, and have worked effectively with people like Cheney and Rumsfeld for a long time. On the other hand, people like Cheney and Rumsfeld had to overcome an initial intense anti-intellectualism, and instead found these sort of nerd-like academics extraordinarily useful. So I think each side found a common interest in the alliance, and of course in their third partner, the evangelical Christians.
Well, from the ones that I know, and then I've had a couple of brushes with the people like Michael Ledeen, to my mind, the neocons hate the CIA because it's one of the few institutions that actually stand up to them. And you know that essentially the Bush administration has been at war with the CIA because, you know, this is the organization that we all grew to detest in the 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. And now they're the people who are telling us the truth about what's really going on. And, of course, that's why the White House is coming down on them. But it seems to me that people like Michael Ledeen and company are just sort of CIA wannabes. You know, they've been trying laying siege to the institution from the outside. They've tried to create their own alternative CIAs, etc. And they believe somehow that the American government are full of feckless wimps and only real men can conduct foreign policy. So when you hear from one of the founders of neoconservatism, Kristol, who said that his definition of a neocon was a liberal who had been mugged by reality. Mm-hmm. It's hard to sustain that idea, given that the neoconservatives, in terms of their foreign policy, have turned out to be wild romantics. In reckless utopians.
Absolutely. I mean, you've really seized on some very interesting aspects of the neoconservatives. That preoccupation with a very curious kind of masculinity, being real men, who go to war. Although, of course, they don't go to war themselves. They send other people, poorer people for the most part. And also the preoccupation with secrets, having a secret. That element of being a CIA wannabe, knowing more than other people, knowing better than other people, having secret knowledge, and that old trope of the secret knowledge is very strong in neoconservative circles. But you're absolutely right, too. And frankly, I think this is no news to America or the world. I mean, their knowing better has not been effective in Iraq, or for that matter, in Afghanistan. People aren't really talking much about Afghanistan, but plenty of young men and women are still getting killed there. And
it was the neocons who shortchanged Afghanistan to fulfill their obsession with attacking Iraq.
Yes, absolutely. Well, and remaking the Middle East, as they, you know, they made no bones about that it was a world historical project with a world historical agenda to reshape a part of the world that had enormous cultural resonance. I think it has had quite a significant effect in reshaping that part of the world, and a very bad one.
Hmm. Well, why are we even talking about these people? They should be pilloried. They should have a stake driven through their hearts for what they've done. And yet they seem to be unimpeachable. At least they're entrenched. Not unimpeachable, but
they're entrenched. They have not yet been impeached, and you know, it is quite startling given the really rather trivial thing for which Clinton was impeached. I think that's the big question in the United States, because you know, if you walk around, you see endless and hear endless out in the world in an ordinary course of things. You see lots of bumper stickers. You hear in the grocery line or, you know, going about your ordinary business, people who are enormously angry at the course that the country has taken. And yet, there is very little of that in the public realm. And I think that's the big question. It's not hard to find people who want to speak, but it's very difficult to make oneself heard. I think probably even more in the East Coast than on the West Coast, that the sort of silencing of criticism, not of criticism of, you know, of Bush, but criticism of the whole direction of American foreign policy, that's hard to come by, not to mention American domestic policy.
Well, you know, we have ethnic cleansing happening in Iraq, but you'd never know about it because for some reason or other the press has bought the White House's line that, you know, that the White House complains that we're not giving enough of the good news in Iraq. Well, there is no good news, but there's a lot of bad news that we're not getting.
Absolutely.
So in spite of this, it seems that the public know that there's something rotten in the state of Iraq. But obviously, the last thing that Bush and the neocons want to talk about is Iraq, and clearly shaping up for the November elections, we can see the contours of the Republican campaign, which is essentially that lesbians are going to steal your wives, gay men will steal your husbands, and Mexicans will steal your jobs. So we're talking about a kind of a tactic, again, not to beat a dead horse, but that's how Hitler rose, by vilifying other people.
Well, there's also the role of the lie, both in the 1930s and at the present, and of course I suppose I should also include the 1960s and Hannah Arendt's work on lying in politics, that the Bush administration has really used that the lie extraordinarily effectively. Just keep saying it. There are weapons of mass destruction. We are succeeding in Iraq. You know, this is repeated over and over again, and it's absolute nonsense. But nevertheless, the administration keeps repeating it, and there are plenty of people on Clear Channel Media and in Fox News who serve as a very effective echo chamber for that. So we, you know, that the use of the lie, just the outright lie, we are succeeding in Iraq. There are weapons of mass destruction. That's been very effective. And,
but in terms of a precursor to fascism, if you divide the country into and put people beyond the pale, like gays and lesbians and Mexicans, then it seems to me that that's the sort of, you know, I mean, maybe, you know, somebody once said that an American fascist would be a corn-pone Nazi, but they certainly seem to be playing to that particular choir, and we've got to wrap up now, but just a quick answer, if you would.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, lots of the disturbing things about fascism are there. The love of a leader, the sort of showy, spectacular patriotism without much content, the vilifying of certain ethnic groups like Mexicans, for example, the construction of a kind of wholesome sexuality, and of course the tarring and feathering and pink triangling of homosexuals. But I think most of all, that expansion of executive power and then the use of executive power against these groups and as a kind of focus for an anti-democratic impulse.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. Ann Norton.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Dr. Ann Norton, who's a professor of political science and comparative literature at the University of Pennsylvania. She has a new article in Adbusters entitled, Is It Fascism Yet? She wrote Leo Strauss and the Politics of American Empire, and her forthcoming book is Abu Ghraib and the American Soul. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Jazz Shepard, the engineer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Kuth, the assistant producer.